Okay, let me just turn this.
Oh, it's not like a bad
song. Let's get all the questions on the screen.
Yeah.
Oh, promise.
Nice. I don't know how you would do that.
Questions. What time is it? Is it time to go to bed yet?
Yeah, with.
Yeah, really. Okay, let me get my caffeination.
What are the classes you teach?
What other class? I teach the neurophysiology lab class next semester.
And
sometimes I teach the grad course in ion channels, how ion channels work. It's a great class. It's been the whole class just on ion channels. And the seminars. And we do a STEMcast class on Wednesday this semester. Okay, so first thing, let's go and just answer any questions that you have over old exams. Remember the last quiz, what did we do? We just took questions straight out of the old exams and just plopped them in because I'm lazy, right? And I just popped them straight in to the quiz. Those were not new questions. And so what am I probably going to be doing Wednesday night? You know, about midnight, probably.
Not
right?
Making up any new ones.
I will make up a few new ones, because I got to make a few new ones.
All right, so
because every year
I
got to increase my test bank.
Three, right?
Yeah, maybe.
That's what
three or
few
four.
Is.
Three.
But
so, this test, I'm going to have to make it, you know, mostly multiple choice. I'll put in some extra questions, like short answers, to give you like 104 or 106 points. And everybody's going to make 100, right? Because you're going to get all 106 percent on this test. That's your curve, basically, to earn it, right? Because you're adding in your bonus questions. Over the years in the past, like these kind of questions with multiple choice, we only have an hour and 15 minutes, so what do we have to do? Mostly multiple choice, you know, to be able to finish. If I put more questions in there, then it's too long, right? You can't finish it in time. So it does add up quickly, right? 2 points for a multiple choice question, there's 50 or a little bit more. Then, you know, you missed one, two, you missed four, that's eight. Oof, you know, you're down there, you're stressing out now. But you got the six, maybe a six or four or six extra points or so in bonus. So maybe you can get those, but you're going to have some short answers too. Remember to really answer those, not a paragraph, main points, right? But I think everybody will finish relatively quick. In the past years, some people have finished multiple choice questions in 35 minutes. If you come in and you know the answers, you can just click through, and they've made an A on these exams in the past. It's not about memorizing the old exams. And that can do you a disservice sometimes by trying to memorize, because you just change the wording and it means something else, right? So be careful. When you look at the old exams, cover up your answers. Read the question. Answer the question in your own head first. And then figure out which answer is the best answer. But go through all your answers and cross out the ones that don't make sense. Just don't jump to the answer, right? Try to think about it. So that's the way to go through the old exams. Remember, you have old exams on the web page up at the top, the summer exams, which had more essay type of questions. Those are always good to go through. But then all the multiple choice questions as well.
Do those summer exams have a? Do the summer exams have a answers anywhere?
No. So the question was, do the summer exams have answers anywhere? No, not really. I don't think. But if you had some problems with them, you know, send an email. Or you can answer the question and send me an email. Does that answer the question? I'll, yes, you know, I'll answer you back. And but generally, you know, look at those questions and try to answer. Now, on old exams, as I mentioned before, some of those exams are not from me. They're from other instructors. Or some years we covered some things more in depth than we did in this semester. Or we covered a different level. But you want to go through all of them. Remember, we didn't cover renal yet. We didn't cover temperature regulation. We didn't cover adaptation. You know, so some of those things don't apply right now. But final exams are also useful to look at because, why? Your final is comprehensive and it goes over the same kind of things. And the things we don't ask on regular hour exams, we tend to look at to try to get for the final exam, just to make sure that you're still studying. Yes?
It's chapter 69,
right? Oh, yeah. So which questions, which... what are we torturing you with? So I wouldn't say chapters so much because lectures, because it depends on which textbook. So we covered behavior, we covered sensory, we went over to muscle, we covered endocrine and we called cardiovascular, right? So when you're going through these PowerPoints, I would do just like this. I would make sure you pull up all of the ones that we've covered and flip through them. And when I mean flip through them, you're flipping through them. Like, just look at sensory, you know? You go through sensory. What did we cover when we went through sensory? So you're flipping through this and you're saying, do I remember these general things? Oh, well, some of these are G-Wizzy, yeah, mechanoreceptors. How is it that you detect sensory transduction and sensory ending? What is it that you're doing? What's happening at sensory ending? What's happening to that protein right there? That ion channel? It's a
stretch activated
ion channel, exactly. Right? And so that causes a greater depolarization, and then boom, right? You get to a threshold of fire and action potential. So those kind of general ideas. Proprioceptors, we talked about those, right? We've talked about generally, like in the crayfish, we talked about ones that, where is that crazy thing? Oh, yeah, wonderful animal. Okay, we talked about these, like the MRO receptor, right? You had a phasic and tonic one, and that it can adapt, right? We call these adaptation, but really that's kind of a misnomer with the word adaptation, right? And other ones that fire the whole time. What is this analogous to in us? How do we detect proprioception? Joint receptors and proprioception. Where your limbs are in space in relation to your body. Proprioception.
So, there's like two types of muscle fibers. What do you think
about muscle? You mean just in general?
Yes.
Well, we have fast and slow muscles in general. That's kind of where we put it. But when we divide up fast, we kind of had different groups of fast, right, or twitch muscles that we call twitch, because in the mammal, our muscles, skeletal muscles are all pretty much twitch muscles. So we may look at some of the invertebrates, right? But our skeletal muscles are really like twitch muscles, right? Because they twitch. But which types do you have? Generally, we divide them up in three groups in this class. You can really divide them up into more groups, but generally, we had what?
Slow oxidative.
Fast oxidative
and
fast glycolytic,
right? And so glycolytic is what? Glycolysis. Oxidative means mitochondria, right? And so, you know, think about these ranges. Is that where you were going?
No, I was talking about the type 1 and type 2 muscle fibers. You're talking about how like 100
mitochondria. Oh, yeah, it's red and white. It's the same idea.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but I was just talking about the extremes, if you will.
Okay.
Oxidative and glycolytic. Yeah, but then you can divide it up. So red and white, what makes it red and white? What's red?
Mitochondria,
lots of capillaries in the mammalian system, right? The capillaries, red blood cells. What else is inside the muscle cell that keeps it kind of red, shine light on it? Myoglobin, right? Myoglobin, mitochondria, increased circulation. Generally, there are three things that you think of with red muscle, right? White muscle, fewer capillary beds, not as many mitochondria, but not as much myoglobin. Oh, the innervation are receptor subtypes. Well, alpha is like the sympathetic, right? And you get alpha 1, alpha 2, and beta. Beta for dilation, right? Like we talked about. And alpha receptors for like contraction. But I think you might be thinking of alpha and gamma. Yes, that's where we're going with this, for example, and this. So what is it in us that allows proprioception? We're back to that point. Proprioception in us? I know you all know. Come on. Right. What do we do? Proprioception. How do we get proprioception? With your limbs. I close my eyes, my head's not moving, but how do I know where my limb is right now? Yeah, what's being stimulated? Is it my joint receptor? If I replace my joint, would I still be able to know where my limb is? If I get a knee replacement, can people still walk without looking at the leg? So it's not the joint receptors, it's the muscle. Remember when I told you we were like a little crayfish? Muscle spindles. This is your interfusal and extrafusal. Did you say that?
Yeah, I said it like three times.
Okay, I didn't hear it.
Speak to the
muscle spindles, okay? And they have the nuclear bag, nuclear chain in there, right? And they're no different, really, than the crayfish system in the sense that one of these, the neurons that goes around there, fires for static positions, stretch, and the other one's dynamic firing, right? And you pull on it. So we're like little crayfish, okay? And you have innervations to the muscles, the bag and chain in the muscle spindle, just like you have innervation in the crayfish to those muscle fibers. What do? They keep the muscle taut, so if it relaxes anymore or stretches anymore, you can always detect it, right? So it's important to understand your proprioception. Well, so I would flip through the PowerPoints. Don't, you know, look at the crayfish too long and be memorized by them, but pretty neat aspects. With, you know, the general ideas, right? We've talked about detection. We've talked about why certain neurons won't keep firing. The proscinium corpus is a standard one on standardized exams, right? This onion layers. So if you push on this, what happens to the firing frequency? Well, first it might respond, but then it quits responding even though you still push on it. Then you take away the stimulus and it might fire again for a little bit. And it's because these onion layers move around it, they don't keep the information on the sensor ending, so it doesn't keep activating stress-activated ion channels. So it's called adaptation, sensory adaptation. But it's not like adaptation like we covered in chapter 1 at the beginning of the class, right? Evolutionarily changing your genome expression levels or something. Okay, and we're talking about, you know, sensory transduction, movement, doesn't matter, moving the hair, it's mechanosensory, right? So these are the kind of things. When we get through the, you know, I would go through every chapter like this. We talk about statocysts. What do they do in an animal? A lobster, for example. You know, just kind of go through each slide. So think about, what did we talk about? The calcium stones that sit on the, you know, gelatin mass that's underneath the sensor neurons. So if that gravity's pulling down, it happens to bend that way, it's going to push more on these, and it's this way, push more. What's the same equivalent in our head? Or how do we detect it? Movement. Close your eyes and hold my head sideways. I know my head sideways.
Semicircular canals.
Uh-huh. Which one?
Semicircular canals.
Is it the semicircular canals? Is it the cochlear? Is it the utriculosaculus? What is it? All of the above? Okay, so let's go with this. So if you move your head around, that causes the fluid to move in your semicircular canals, right? So velocity, movement, forward acceleration, deacceleration, that's semicircular canals. The snail-like structure is for what?
Hearing.
Hearing. And how to remember that? Remember the, like, the big snail thing and you blow a horn through it, like you see on TV, right? You know, the snail-like structure, sound, okay? And then the other part, utriculus and sacculus. So these little otolith organs, utriculus and sacculus, are no different. We look at these over here, these otoliths that sit on top of the gelatin mass, that sit on top of hair cells, they are the same as like that lobster statocysts, right? They sit on and they, where do they exist? They exist right there where the utricula and sacula are, the cavities, sacculus cavity and the utricular cavity, they sit in those regions and they detect the static position of your head. Semicircular canals for more dynamic movement, right? And people do tests with this. It's really quite cool. Cold water in one ear or warm water in the other causes a convection current. You can actually know exactly what that person should be doing, how they're going to respond to that, if they're responding correctly to just this temperature difference. It's pretty neat. Okay, so this is the idea to go through this. What else does that structure look like that we've looked at? This cupola, these hair cells, with the structure around it, it's no different than the lateral line on a fish, right? It's the same kind of structure. It's amazing, right? From fish to humans, used in us to detect these movements of the fluid in the fish, its movements of fluid on the outside of the animal. Similar structure and function. Okay. So kind of flip through there and kind of think about, well, what did we cover? We covered a little bit about hearing, too. You know, mechanosensory transduction, sound waves, membrane that then moves three bones around, that then causes fluid to move in the snail-like structure, the cochlea, right? Moves that fluid. And what does it do? I didn't want to dive down to all the nitty-gritty details, but to know the general points. Well, if this fluid moves, that moves this membrane, and then that causes this hinge to move back and forth, and that hand, which is a little pectoral membrane, is the main thing. Remember, this pectoral membrane sits on top of these hair cells. So if it bends this way or that way, it's going to change how these hair cells move. That sound wave is going to deform that membrane depending on the frequency of that sound wave. So depending on the frequency, you get different movements in different parts of that structure. So you can actually have a tonotopic arrangement, low frequencies or high frequencies to low frequencies out here, and it's arranged, and the neurons that come out, as we said in class, project to the same spot, you know, to a same kind of arrangement into the brainstem. So it's tonotopically arranged here, continues that tonotopic arrangement in the brainstem. You can put an electrode inside of that brainstem in that area, give them that sound, and you know you will have activity. And that those neurons there, because of the arrangement, is the same. So pretty cool. What else would be? Taste. We talked a little bit about taste, right? What was the main thing about taste that we talked about? Did we talk about that you had to memorize every type of these channels? No. But what was the general points that we talked about? That Carolina channels, right? And you might be macrotropic type of channels too, like macrotropic channels. It might be inotropic channels, but generally, not always, but the general idea is that they're activated, right? They depolarize, they fire responses. Their projections to the brain are again arranged where that neuron goes to that part of the brain, so you perceive that's a sour taste or that's a sweet taste, right? So it's again, you know, kind of hardwired. Tonotopic in this case means that it's arranged by tone, the same, like that sound wave coming out of the cochlea. Those neurons keep that same arrangement and go with the brain in the same arrangement. So if we look in the brainstem now, where the vestibular cochlear nerve goes into, you can record in that brainstem in those regions. You can say that region's low frequency, this region's high frequency, and it's that same arrangement. The same thing with tactile sense. Remember the homunculus on the head, the sensory homunculus, the shape of the body on the cortex? It's arranged the same way. The motor cortex is the same. It's the same idea. And even taste is the same. It's arranged the same way on your taste bud. If you can go into the brain and you can actually map out that those neurons go to that part, and that's the part in your brain on the olfactory nerve would go to, are the, you know, taste for detecting those particular odorants. But the main point was that these channels generally allow depolarization of the cell. Sometimes this is a little confusing because it show all of them on one neuron, but we have different neurons for some of these different tastes too, so it's kind of neat. We didn't, you know, some of the stuff we didn't really get into too much about olfaction. Just that you have these different things and that they turn over and they have a high turnover rate, right? And so when you look through there, you see the main things that we covered. We didn't go through a lot on the eye evolutionarily development or different types of eyes, but there were some main things we talked about. What was the main thing we talked about? Insect eye, vertebrate eye. What's the difference? What's the insect eye, the unit called? Omatidia, right? Does the omatidia, when light shines on it, the cells that detect the light, do they depolarize or hyperpolarize? The omatidia, the insect eye, depolarize. Now the rods and cones in the vertebrate eye, when light goes on them, what happens to those cells? They hyperpolarize, right? And so maybe what did we talk about? Why do they hyperpolarize? Let's think about the mechanism. So this is the way to go through these figures, right? So when we're talking about what goes through the eyes, we didn't talk about all that stuff too much, right? We didn't worry about that. 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 We did talk about the optic nerve, right, in the blind spot. We did that exercise across the street. We did talk about, you know, red and white, red, blue, and green, you know, different opsins. We did talk about rods and cones, which ones for color. See, for color. Cones for color. Where they highly localized the fovea, right? Rods on the periphery for white light. And then when we got into the retina, the main things we talked about, like rods and cones. We didn't worry about all this other kind of little nitty-gritty innervation stuff that goes on. We said it's like a little brain, right? Integrates. The optic nerve comes out, and that makes where the blind spot is, right? Because you don't have any rods and cones there. What else goes in here? What allows the spatial acuity to be so great for edge contrast? What's the key thing that we're looking for?
Lateral inhibition.
So where the lights are strongest, that can inhibit the neighboring cells, so you activate those cells and cause a lot of oxidation on the rest. Right. But we should know about the currents in these, and the rods and cones, because that's even on standardized exams too, but also in here. What's the main points here? Well, in the dark, you're depolarized. Why are you depolarized? Because of what's coming into the cell.
Sodium.
So we call that what type of current?
Dark current.
The dark current. The dark beta, right? So the dark current. Because in the dark, you have the sodium current. But in the light, they close. And so if the sodium's not coming in anymore in your clothes, remember the cells want to go to the more or less the E potassium. So what do? They hyperpolarize. They go down. They're more negative. And so with light, they become more negative. Now, on old exams, I think there's one that actually asks the question, in the cones and rods, with light, do you have more vesicular fusion, more transmitter release, or less transmitter release? If you hyperpolarize it, it's less, right? Because there's less calcium to come in to cause the vesicles to fuse. It's the same process for vesicle fusion process that the rods and cones down here, right? It's the same process of calcium coming in and depolarizing vesicle fusion. So if you hyperpolarize, you're not depolarized, you have less. So in the dark, it's actually enhancing transmitter release. So vesicles are turning over all the time. That's pretty wild, right? You're not being used, that you're actually having more activity. I think that's very energy inefficient, right? It's kind of interesting, you know, process. Maybe the insect's a better efficiency to the system than a vertebrate eye. Okay. Kind of cool. So when you look through there, you know, this is the kind of way to look through that. That's still the same thing that we just went through. Don't be intimidated by all the other stuff. It's generally the big picture that we just talked about. Rods and cones, you know, color. And then we didn't talk about, we didn't really get into this too much, so would I worry about it? No. But what did we talk about when we were over the outreach center? We talked about, like, the occipital cortex is back here. If you get your head back, right, you bruised it, you might have visual problems. We generally talked about that. compound eyes, we just talked about with omatidia and rods and cones. We didn't get into this eye development too much this year. We did talk about lateral inhibition was first described in invertebrate eyes, particularly in the horseshoe crabs. Got a Nobel Prize for that. Pretty cool that those animals do that. We talked a little bit about thermal receptors, like the rattlesnake. Remember rattlesnakes? Really cool. Come to my hometown, Sweetwater, Texas. I'll treat you to a rattlesnake roundup and some snake meat. Okay. Crazy stuff. But pretty neat that they can detect not only their prey that they need, but also environmental changes. We did talk about pain a little bit. Didn't we talk about pain? And this is kind of important because these pain pathways, this is where the endemic is, you know, across America right now, right? Opioid receptors, right? Opioids, taking opioids. This is a big problem that people, you know, after surgery, they get hooked on pain meds. And good grief, it's a real problem because people are dying left and right on this stuff. And so this is important to try to understand this idea. And even like the runner's high, right? You run all the time, what happens? You get an endorphin release called endogenous morphine. But morphine works on these receptors, right? They work on these opioid receptors. So people that run all the time, if they can't run, let's say it's bad weather, they get really frustrated, right? They're don't have that endorphin high anymore. It's kind of like this addiction that they have. They really do get addicted to running or exercise. So they might go into a gym to exercise. But it actually relaxes them. And it gives them this endogenous morphine. So if you really need pain medication, maybe exercising in some way, if it's not going to hurt you, then lift weights if you have a broken leg, for example. Okay, so what is happening? Nociceptive cells are pain cells, right? Pain neurons. They go into your dorsal horn. Remember the butterfly shape in the dorsal horn? Remember that? Dorsal horn, ventral horn, motor neurons, dorsal horn, sensory innervation, dorsal ganglion outside, projections in. This is sensory input. Now we're inside the dorsal horn. What's going on? You have descending control that can release endorphins onto these receptors to inhibit this neuron from releasing substance P. Right? Substance P then is your for your pain, for example. So endogenous opioids block that, right? So it's kind of neat to think about.
This is where you regulate your pain. Important to try to understand the general points to this.
We talked about capsaicin at one time, I think, you know, people that inject capsaicin, maybe in the paws of mice and rats, and they don't feel the pain reception anymore. They can actually walk in a hot plate and actually burn their skin. Because high doses of capsaicin over time can actually kill out these neurons. They can actually destroy the sensory neurons, so you don't release, you don't detect it. So that's pretty interesting. This is why sometimes people, when you keep eating more hot food, that they actually have maybe changed their whole, or desensitized, or maybe even destroyed some of their receptors to detect capsaicin or detect the pain. Analgetic control, like with shingles, you know, you put capsaicin cream on to get rid of the pain for those shingles. It's not to kill them, but it's kind of to desensitize these receptors or make them where they don't work so well. It's kind of interesting processes. Electroreception, it was kind of gee-whizzy, but, you know, electric fish have electric field around them. They can detect if it changes because something might interfere with that, so they know a predator's here or a stick there or something that was inhibiting them. The electric organ we mentioned is really kind of cool because why? This is such a high acetylcholine receptor, so people isolated the first acetylcholine receptors from here and did x-ray crystallography, kind of ringing the bell. Remember all that? No? It's all past long lectures ago. But kind of neat that they can generate electric field, the meaning behind it. Magnetoreceptors, migratory birds, for example, right? Earth magnetic field. That's the whole chapter, right? So you basically finished reviewing that chapter. Now what do we have? We have some other chapters. That was an easy chapter, granted. Now we get to the endocrine chapter, and it's like, oh. But really, when you think of the endocrine chapter, what did we really go over? I mean, some of the things you really got to know, you got to memorize. We talked about some major points, like thyroid hormone, you know, the releasing hormones. And then they go, all releasing hormones are from where? Hypothalamus. And then they work on the anterior pituitary, right? But the posterior is not a releasing hormone, right? That's what two hormones?
Oxytocin.
Yeah, so that's then, they're made in the hypothalamus and their nerve terminals are released, the hormone from the posterior pituitary. After 9 hours, I'm going to begin to defeat the curious. Okay, so, you know, kind of get these things down. But that's, you know, once you get that down, you've got that pretty well down. But other things, like, you know, pick anything that you, calcium regulation. What two hormones for calcium regulation?
Calcitonin.
Calcitriol is kind of like a drug. But calcitonin, right? And parathyroid. And then we talk about like bones with vitamin D and stuff, but you know, the main thing was calcium for calcium regulation, calcitonin and parathyroid. And which one increases your plasma calcium levels?
Parathyroid.
How does it increase calcium levels in your blood? Where do you get the calcium from?
Break down the
bone, right? And so two types of cells generally in bone. I don't know if we mentioned this before, but you know, osteoclast builds, osteoclast tears away, right? So it stimulates osteoclast, breaks down bone. Some of it depends on the animal. There's more actions in some than others. But with parathyroid hormone, increases calcium in the blood. That's one way to do it, by stimulating osteoclast. But where does the calcium come from? In the air? Where do you get calcium from? How does it get into your body when you're growing?
Milk.
That means through diet, right? So you're getting it through the diet. So what's another way to increase calcium into the blood if you have parathyroid? Do you want it to go through the GI tract or do you want to get it out of your GI tract? So parathyroid can actually help with absorption of calcium from your GI tract. What happens when it goes in your blood? What happens when you make urine? Pee it out, right? You can lose your calcium. But parathyroid can have some action on the kidney to help with calcium reabsorption, too, in your kidneys. So it maintains calcium. So different ways that parathyroid can work to maintain calcium. So just kind of don't freak out to try to memorize the answer. but think about, oh, these are all ways that calcium can be increased in your blood. Now, how does calcium, it's high, and you want to get calcium into the bones, build bones, stimulate osteoblasts. What did we tell you to remember? The corny analogy? Calcitonin is related to?
Toning your muscles.
Tone in the bone, right? Calcitonin, tone, bone in the bone, right? Calcitonin. I know these corny things, but hopefully it will help you remember these things. And so that helps with. There's a weird story about with calcitonin. There was a pharmaceutical company, I think it was in Dallas, Texas, that was going to stop making calcitonin that actually people needed for maintaining their calcium, which is important, right? For osteoporosis and things like that. So they said, we're not making a big enough market. We're going to quit selling it. But people need it to survive. So, but the company said, well, we don't have to make it. So actually, that was pretty bad because they used people as a bargaining tool. And they actually went to Congress a long time ago. And Congress actually had to support the company to help make their calcitonin. But they revealed that this company was already a multi-million dollar or billion-dollar company making a lot of money off everything else. It's kind of like that AIDS drug that we've heard about recently. And they did supplement that company with a government subsidy to help them keep making calcitonin. It was really kind of a bad deal. But you see where these companies actually play games with some of these things, and they were making a lot of money already. But so it actually relates your physiology, understanding what's going on, and how the companies do things. So it's kind of interesting to think about. So go through each chapter that way. We just did the simple one with sensory. We just finished cardiovascular, so that should be pretty fresh, but I know there's a lot there. But think about what we covered in class before, and we're going to cover some tomorrow, right? Try to pull it together a little bit, more on the EKG a little bit. And behavior, there wasn't a lot in the behavior aspect. There was some fun kind of gee-whizzy things just to kind of pull it together. Yes?
Yeah, I was going to ask, what do we need to know from behavior since we didn't cover it in class?
We covered a little bit of it, right?
Yeah, a little bit.
But it wasn't a lot.
It was just kind of gee-whizzy things. It's kind of fun. When you went through it, there wasn't too many PowerPoints to it either. Well, let's just look through it, sensory processing, right? You process sensory information in CNS and then make it motor output, right? And that's the whole behavior of the animal. You have to have a motor output for the behavior, right? So, all that processing and how cells respond to that. Talked about even pineal cells, right? The third eye that can detect in the fish or in the bird, right? Because light can go through the skull on the bird and actually activate the pineal gland so it can detect light. Same in the fish. So it has these sensory transduction. We talked about this kind of over in the outreach centers where we did that behavioral component. We did a lot of the homunculus, two-point discrimination, the taste test. Remember the taste test? Remember the hot tamales, the cinnamon? Hold your nose. Remember that? You weren't there in the outreach center when we did that?
It was in the classroom.
Oh, we did that in the classroom with the hot tamales? Okay. And then we did the two-point discrimination in the outreach center. Right, and what was the whole reason behind that? To look at why you're more sensitive in the fingertips than, say, on the back of your arm or in the back of your shoulder blades. Small receptive fields overlapping, so you get a high density of sensory reception, but small receptive fields and overlap, you can detect the two-point discrimination. So those kind of general points. And then, a simple nerve network to more complex systems. What did we talk about here? We talked about a simple ganglion, for example, right, in the leech or in the aplasia. And this got a person a Nobel Prize, Eric Kandel, which was a clinical psychiatrist, actually, at Columbia. And he wanted to understand how the nervous system works. He wanted to understand how memory works. So he actually did a lot of his work in the aplasia. He runs a gigantic lab at Columbia. But he actually doesn't really practice clinical psychiatry, but he started off that way. So what's the advantage of some of these systems that we talked about, like with the aplasia and the leech system? What did they do? Remember that? I spent 4 years of my life on the leech system. I know. Horrible. The leech system up there, those cells that we talked about, you can monitor an individual cell. You could stimulate that. The glia took up, potassium, right? It actually was the first concept of what glial cells actually do, and that related to our brain. We have more glia in our brain than we do neurons. That maybe they're actually the sink for potassium, the activity of neurons. Plus, you have an identified neuron. You can record from that and actually look at the shape of the action potential. You can look at the connections in this. Regeneration and repair were first done in the leech nervous system to understand regeneration and repair in higher animals. So pretty neat little things, the leech system. And that's just one ganglion leech. Remember that little critter we brought to the lecture room? The leech, Mary? We need our leeches fed if anybody wants to volunteer. No? Okay. Extra points? No extra points? No
extra points?
You might have to get sepsis from this thing. And, of course, if you can't answer any question, what do? You just draw a crayfish picture and hope for extra credit, right? Okay, so, we talked about behavior in general, the segmental animals. We talked about, synaptic control. It's really kind of neat. Your alpha motor neurons actually have two types of nerve terminals on muscle as well as on neuron. And they can have different types of synapses. It depends on the target. There is this Renshaw cell that was really quite interesting. Feedback, negative feedback process on your alpha motor neurons. Just that you have these standardized type of behaviors. Probably cover this in ecology. Hardwired versus plastic changes. And we didn't really go into all those details, but we did talk about competition, right? Activity competition, right? Critical periods, right? Like with your eye, Ubel and Fiesel got the Nobel Prize for this because the activity in the eyes competing for target cells of the optic nerve where they project to and making these different patterns in the lateral and the geniculate where they project to. It all depends on activity patterns. We didn't really get into all this detail here. There was just too much. So you can kind of speed through that part. Another beautiful picture, just to stir at the crayfish tail flip response, right? First behavior worked out from neuron to neuron to understand the whole neural circuit. Really quite cool. We didn't talk too much about that. Bird brain, we talked about that it's under regulation in some birds, singing birds like canaries, zebra finches, that they can change during the seasons. The brain changes. It increases the number of neurons, and those neurons project to other target cells, so the adult brain changes, and these neuronal numbers hypertrophies and actually projects into the right locations. That's pretty cool, all under hormonal control. And we talked about receptors as well, like in the different animals, the ones that like grooming versus ones that don't groom much, all had to do basically the receptors, not so much the hormone, but the receptors to the hormone. And that they could inject transgenic mice or have them express the arginine vasopressin receptor, and they would increase their grooming behavior just by having their increased receptor, which relates to humans, or think that this relates to humans in the sense of some humans don't cuddle their infants very well. Maybe they don't have this bonding. Maybe they're lacking arginine vasopressin receptors in their brain somewhere. This is where the kind of studies have gone in this aspect with these kind of critters. Then the rest of this chapter had to do mostly with the sympathetic and parasympathetic system, pretty much. And, the homunculus two-point discrimination we covered. And the gas system, like you all are in right now, the exhaustion phase, probably, right? You stay in it constantly until you graduate. Then the other exhaustion phase will come in about job stress and life stress. So your whole life is in an exhaustive phase, basically. So that's why you want to just retire and go off and become the campground host and deliver firewood to the different campgrounds and just to hell with the rest of the world. Right? So I'm sorry. That's where I'm going when I retire. Campground host. So we talked about sympathetic, parasympathetic divisions and basically the different kinds of control that goes on there and the different receptor subtypes in those. All right. And then that was basically the end of it. And we've already covered some of this with cardiovascular system, right? And so there, boom, the behavior chapter's done. So we've just reviewed two chapters. You only have three more to go and you're gone. You're just ready to go. You get a good night's sleep Wednesday night.
Quick. This is like... question, but the difference between macrocellular versus paracellular?
So the question was about macrocellular and paracellular. We didn't go into that depth this year about the different types of those hypothalamic neurons, so I wouldn't ask about those. Some of those depends
on ADH, whereas ADH.
Yes. And we won't go into that part, that depth. All right. Questions though on old exams? Anybody have? Download those, look through them. Make sure you just don't try to memorize the answers, but you actually work through it, right? Okay, I know. In all your spare time, you don't have anything else to do in life, just physiology.
I have another exam Thursday.
You got another one Thursday?
I have two exams that people do Thursday.
Oh, good grief. Okay. Well, hopefully you use the weekends well.
Yeah, I have a thermodynamics exam.
Oh, good God.
Fine.
It's going to be a horrible week.